like to introduce now our next speaker for Save Our Sands, Howard Lyons.
Thank you. Culture is very important. Great speech, Hugo. Thank you very much. Lots of lovely pics. I haven't got any. Basically, I'm an unreconstructed academic, although I have lots of other hats. When I go to meetings, generally speaking, people say, which hat are you wearing now? Or even when I speak, I vary the hats. Being an unreconstructed academic, though, at heart, I've got a handout. So I'm just going to talk to my presentation rather than read it. I think there are some very important things to cover. I think there's some fascinating differences between SAS and SOS. They are a big organisation, lots of clout. We're very much of a small local community organisation. Where appropriate, we have chats with them. We've done a bit of work with them. We're not in competition. We're just utterly different. And we have different stories and different lessons to actually provide. Oh, yeah. I think it's important, again saying that I'm an academic, we were given a brief and I've stuck to it. You know, I'm a great believer in, or have been as an academic, telling students to answer the question, and I'm afraid I've done so. And these were the questions that we were set. The vision of a sustainable Cornwall, what do we do to fit in with the vision? What about Cornish culture and identity in the context? And what behavioural challenges does SOS face? Bit of a problem, actually. I produced my presentation and circulated amongst a few colleagues, and they said, well, actually, it doesn't follow too well. And I realised that what we were actually trying to do, and this, I think, is very much a reflection on this conference, bringing together two distinct themes at the moment, is very much in the foothills of asking some important questions. And it struck me as being a bit like a doctoral student trying to put together their research question at the start. So some of the things that I'll be dealing with, because I'm answering the question set, don't coalesce terribly well. But I think that there is an important learning curve issue there for folk. We're a small charity, a very small charity, and there is an important point here that I want to make to you, that in terms of the Charity Commission, they've got three types of charity, and we're the under £5,000 one. And we work very hard to stay under £5,000, because it means we can use a boilerplate Charity Commission constitution and structure, but we don't have any of the overheads, any of the messing around, any of the complexity of registration and returns. So as long as we keep clear of that, and it's often a struggle to make sure we stay under 5,000, because, you know, it's hard not to do fundraising activities from time to time. But as long as we manage it, it means we can actually function quite freely, but still claim to be a charity, which is in fact what we are. And I think as a sort of community issue, that might be something that some of you want to take home. The actual history of the group has been quite interesting and has emerged and changed and is an ongoing process. Basically, it was all about absentee landowners, people stealing the sand from the bay. We don't actually know how much sand has been removed from St Ives Bay. It could be, it's certainly above 500,000 metric tonnes, and it could be 1,000,000 metric tonnes. Basically, St Ives Bay is a closed cell, which means that in practical terms, the sand in the cell isn't replenished. So that's from St Ives to Godrina. Any sand removed. And what we were facing over the decades is the excuse of Hale Harbour silting up as an excuse to actually remove sand and sell it. And quite interestingly, when I say interesting, actually quite horrifyingly, one might argue that you remove the sand from the harbour entrance by dredging and dump it somewhere else in the bay. Not allowed historically, because of the level of contamination and heavy metal pollution in the area. And yet, what happened to that sand? It was sold for agricultural top dressing. What we do and what we continue to do is lobby. And in the past, the group was very adversarial and vociferous, had lots of articles, lots of letters in the Cornishman and the West Briton. And personally, I think that that was an extremely positive and important part in terms of developing the power of the organisation. Because I think one of the things that's absolutely essential is that small lobby groups have to punch above their weight. It's very easy to feel overwhelmed by the large institutions you face, whether it's Cornwall Council or the Environment Agency, for example. But get it the other way around and think in terms of marine warfare. If you've got a damn great battleship or aircraft carrier, it's a very vulnerable asset, and that's what those large organisations are. And that properly directed, a small organisation can really damage it below the waterline. So you have to have a clear view, if you're a small organisation, about how you operate. And you have to have a track record. In terms of evidence of SOS's successes, we actually had a memorandum of understanding with ING, who owned the harbour, not to sell sand. Now, at one level, that seems absolutely trivial, and it wasn't a binding contract. But it's held. All sorts of other processes have been in place that have supported it as well. Section 106s have been supportive. Cornwall Council officers have been supportive. All sorts of people have been supportive. But that was basically, I think, because Save Our Sand was prepared in the first place to make a lot of noise and actually be a real reflection of a local anger. And that's something that's an ongoing part of the sort of narrative I want to share with you. And in terms of actually why I got involved in Save Our Sand myself, both in terms of being enthused by the spirit of the organisation, but also enjoying a bit of a punch-up when necessary as a character. So we've got a number of things that are just basically examples of successes. And in terms of comparing us with SAS, it's irrelevant. They're big, we're tiny, their successes may be huge. Ours are very local, but actually as important, or probably at some level more important to our local population. We're looking at the really big issues of heavy metal pollution, and I have a very strong feeling that it took 250 years to foul the area, to foul the county. And so I believe very, very passionately, and I actually get annoyed with people generally speaking who talk about, I believe this passionately, but I do, that we actually need to find a way of espousing and owning the notion that if it took 250 years to create the mess, let's give ourselves at least 50 years to clean it up. And that's very difficult. Looking around the room, there's a minority of people who have a reasonable expectation of actually still being here in 50 years. You know, the length of human lifespan is problematic in this context. But nonetheless, I think we have to find ways of owning it. And this again goes to the big environmental issues in every sense. The notion of a sustainable Cornwall is where I'm coming to in terms of this 50-year. I'm wanting to talk, and we have actually got a sort of dialogue with the SI about that, although we're struggling to get some money from DEFRA. Let me just make a few little comments about this. I'll leave it for the podcast. Firstly, I think what the Environment Agency do in terms of flood prevention is frankly fab. Hale hasn't had a proper flood since, I gather, the 80s. But they actually take the responsibility to an extent that means they are overly protective. their sort of criteria for ensuring that flooding is averted are very, very, very low risk-taking. They're very, very risk-averse. And many of the things we have to do in terms of improving the county are actually going to be seen as risky, even to the extent that if you dig nasties up, they have to be taken arguably to Swindon if you can't find a way of reprocessing them locally to get value out of them. And sometimes they have to be taken in trucks with police escorts, we're told. And yet, you know, Hale is beautiful and lots of other places that you live are beautiful, and we know, certainly for Hale, that very few inches down, a spoonful would kill a child, if not an adult. And that goes for the land in Hale and also the sea in the bay. SOS has lobbied and we've marched. It has, as I say, been very adversarial. But at the present time, we're in a very different position. And myself, I'm on the Town Council and the Neighbourhood Planning Committee and all of those institutions. Another of the colleagues who's one of the trustees of SOS is also on the Town Council. At the moment, we're influencing by being inside that tent. But we are very clear that we retain the potential. And certainly in terms of my past experience, as I say, had lots of hats over lots of periods of time. And one of the things I was a member of the University and College Trade Union and worked on the contract at my university in terms of pay scales and actually got the best deal in the country for our sector in terms of wages. But we did it not by being the enemy of the management in terms of the way we operated, but by understanding their needs and finding ways of actually explaining and in fact doing their job, doing the job in that case of the Human Resources Department, of creating paperwork leading to the new contract. So I think you do have to do some heavy lifting if you want to be successful. It's not all about making a lot of noise and telling the other bugger what to do. Can't say that strongly enough. Cornish culture, which was the question, or one of the questions. I find it a bit difficult. At one level, I mean, for example, I belong to a folk club. I'm not a singer, but I belong to a folk club. And I have a very strong sense of a lot of the local music being about mining and farming and fishing. So in some senses, I have a very strong sense of what it means. But in terms of actually tying it into the SOS story, it becomes a little bit more tentative. And I probably end up making some enemies in the room today over some of the comments. There is, I feel, in terms of a spiritual link, something about the Trelawney story, the people in Cornwall actually have, and it comes back also to the rugby, if you like, that strong sense of place and of culture, whatever that means, and a willingness to fight for it, whatever it is. But there are some difficult bits about Cornish culture as well. And I think that if you want to start talking about Cornish culture, we have to be open and honest about those issues. My own experience has been rather more until recently in South Yorkshire. And I've got some... part of what I've done in that paper is I've given a brief biopic of myself. It's been a bit selective because I'm very sort of keen that you understand where I'm coming from in terms of my analysis and synthesis of issues. And I find huge similarities in South Yorkshire in terms of strong working class culture, early industrial revolution, exploitation, and that raft of issues. But I also find And I've been trying to tease it out in the context of coming here today. I've been trying to tease out the key issue in terms of difference. And I think that, for example, in Sheffield, the Socialist Workers' Party may not be significant in terms of numbers, but they can put people out in the streets to sell the newspaper. It's very much a Labour Party with a very hard red edge to it. In fact, South Yorkshire was once known as the People's Republic. Cornwall, on the other hand, is much more about, I think, the Co-op Party in a strange sense, although it may not be significant, culturally is reflective. Certainly the Liberal Party rather than the Liberal Democrats in a party political sense. And I've kind of learned a bit about the attitudes of Methodism to organising and disputing. And I, for example, hadn't realised that the Methodists were against trade unionism and actually adversarial politics.
Can you wrap up in about 3 minutes?
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry. Three's enough.
Yeah, sure.
So I think, you know, in terms of just trying to put some themes and little ideas out, which may be a load of nonsense, and I'm happily going to be shot down, because I'm here to learn as well. But I hope at least there's some value in terms of that perspective. So, Cornish culture, strong working class worldview. SOS, the previous chair was actually a blue-collar trade union organiser, even though there are sort of landowners and local business people involved in the organisation. It's very much of a working class local organisation. And it's an organisation where our meetings are sparsely attended, but if we have coffee mornings or beach cleans, people come out of the woodwork. Fabulous. They don't want to come and talk, go to a talking shop, they want to do stuff. Brilliant. Bit of a fear here that even at the moment the sort of identification of Cornish culture is still about basically injustice and reacting to that, and I think turning that round into a positive is actually quite challenging, because there is basically cultural assimilation very evident in all communities. Final point is the one about corporatism, and it's something that I'm very conscious of, having been incorporated into, if you like, the local town council and the various other institutions, that one has to quite clearly be prepared to change hats. One has a role, one speaks from a role, can then move on. Thanks.
There's so much in there that we could discuss, but unfortunately, perhaps one question, and then there's time for discussion this afternoon. Hale is a fantastic example, isn't it? Historical example. My company was involved as an ecological clerk of works down there when they put in the new bridge, and just we were asked to go in with Carillion, who actually got the contract. Another company, shall be nameless, asked us if we'd go in with them, and I said, well, we won't, because we're committed to going with Carillion. And they said, oh, well, it doesn't matter anyway. There's no environmental issues down there anyway. We'd only want somebody to do about 10 days' work. And we were down there every day. And I said to them, if you've got that attitude, you will never get anywhere near getting the contract. And what an old-fashioned view that was of a big engineering company. Because the issues were so complex down there. But anyway, has anybody got a quick question?
Hi, my name's Kate. I'm a third year history student here. I just wondered who ING were and who owns them.
It's the Dutch bank. It's the Dutch bank that's in hock to the Dutch government, just as RBS and so on, Lloyds, are in this country. And thank God they've almost gone in terms of an active presence, but they haven't quite gone.